Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
On this week's episode of Office Hours, we're doing something slightly bit different. One of our listeners, David Philippi, reached out to us recently and asked if he could occasionally contribute to our podcast by doing his own set of interviews. As we're always looking here at the Office Hours to cut down on our own work, we were more than happy to make him an official guest contributor. So stay tuned to David's first premiere interview with Francisco Dunia from Bates College, which we have to say turned out really well. If doing free labor for us and making your own interview sounds like a good idea, let us know. Maybe we can work something out. We're always looking to do less work here at the Office Hours. Or at least be more efficient. David?
For this episode, I talked to Francesco Dunia, Associate Professor and Chair of the Sociology Department at Bates College, about his new book on the American obsession with winning. He shares some of the experiences that motivated and informed his work, from watching sports and raising young kids to teaching in Denmark, a much less competitive but much more content nation. His observations lead to some tough questions. What are we really trying to gain by competing, and are we getting it? Does the constant use of the language of winning and losing lead us to misinterpret ourselves and our society? Let's hear what he has to say. All right, I'm talking with Francesco Dunia, professor of sociology at Bates College, whose most recent book, Winning, Reflections on an American Obsession, was published a few months ago. Francesco, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about your motivations for writing the book? It's something I've thought about a lot, but how did you decide to write a whole book about it?
Well, I decided to write a whole book about it for a number of related reasons, but primarily incidents, really. I remember many years ago, watching Michael Jordan win his fifth championship with the Chicago Bulls. And, after a very grueling season, the confettis were still falling. He had just won. He was still sweating. He was hugging the trophy, and with his fingers, it flashed six. And I thought, why work so hard for 9 months, and the very moment to achieve what you wanted to achieve, you were really disregarding it in a sense and looking forward. And other examples include, when walking down the hallway into my kids' daycare here in Maine, there are three posters with drawings of Superman-like kids. And one poster says "we," the next one says "are," and the next one says "super kids." And I spent a year in Denmark, 7 or 8, and I was stunned by how different their approach is to these sorts of things. And winning and losing is everywhere in our culture and in our society. And I thought that we take it so much for granted, and we push so hard, ourselves and others, to win. But as with many other things in life, we seldom stop and think about what those terms mean. And so I thought somebody ought to do it, and I decided to delve into it.
Yeah, well, I think you do a really good job. Like you point out, it's kind of that something that we take for granted. And in your approach, you draw out a few things that are almost so obvious that we wouldn't think to question them. You kind of make it a little bit more explicit. Early in the book, you point out we're not just obsessed with winning as such. We're not trying to be the best in competition against a bunch of six-year-olds. We want to be the best of the best. You write, "We seek our equals in the hope of proving to ourselves and the world that they are not, after all, equal to us."
Right.
And this seems to get to something that I've thought a lot about, and that's this tension that seems to exist between these kind of supreme values of equality and liberty. It's almost as if liberty carries this imperative to distinguish yourself from the people who are supposed to be your equals. Do you see this tension at like the level of core American values, or is it something else?
No, I think you're pointing to a core thing there, a core idea, and that is that in a world where things are undifferentiated, at least in principle, everybody's born equal, right? And we all have the same rights and in theory should have all the same opportunities. With that kind of setup, there comes enormous pressure to define ourselves and to almost feel like, we actually legitimately belong here. We're not lost in the sea of, indifference. And we pursue victory, we pursue competition, and we want to win so much because somehow we think that will help us to define our identity. I just got an invitation to speak to in a hospital for doctors in training. And the person who was organizing it said, "Love to have you here. It would be fantastic. I read the first chapter of your book already, and I have to say I disagree with it so much because I am so competitive. I want to win so much, but I don't know why. I'm like, well, then you agree with me.
Yeah. Well, at least he admitted he had only read the first chapter.
Right. So. Right. But on the other hand, I'm like, you know, but you don't know why. That's precisely the point.
Right.
You don't know why. And so the question is, you know, why? And I think that, well, before you get to the final point, which is you already got to, in a sense, you know, we want to establish ourselves, find out who we really are, but we will never will by process of competing, incidentally. You know, there are three things that we actually are sort of intermediate goals. And one is differentiation, as you pointed out. But also there are other things like being proven right, wanting to prove ourselves right in general. You know, we are right. We have a right mindset. And then, as I talk in the book, a chapter on space, we want to have both physical and as well as mental space. And that's something that victory kind of gives you, is physical space, you know, to a very material sense, you get bigger things and so on and so forth, but also mental space. You know, if you're a winner, you have to deal less with noise from outside. You know, you're more allowed to be entitled to your opinions in a certain way. Yeah. You know, buffer zone. And, you know, Michael Jordan doesn't have to listen to anybody, right? He's a winner. He doesn't have to. Bill Gates doesn't have to listen to anybody in theory, you know? Because he's very good at making money with computers, you know?
Right.
So he doesn't have to listen to anybody. I think that's a very indicative thing of what we're, you know, it's mid-level sort of prize. You know, underneath that, if you dig deeper, it's really our desire to just want to be proven legitimate, that we belong, you know?
Yeah, that kind of gets to another one of these contradictions. You say on the one hand, we have this tendency to view every activity in life as some kind of a competition and try to win at everything. And then on the other hand, you know, life gets reduced to one defining event or one defining sphere, and we can prove ourselves right in just that one area. And, you know, the fact that you can almost have those two things happening simultaneously seems to me another indication of what you were just talking about, and not really being sure how to define ourselves. I mean, obviously, if that one defining event is significant enough to prove ourselves right, so to speak, you know, you'd want to go in that direction. Maybe it's kind of a mental thing where if you can't have that one defining event, you have to look at a whole variety of events. But I think when you draw out these kind of things, I think it helps to show how it's kind of happening on both the level of society, but also the individual mind kind of at the same time.
That's right. I mean, I think that your point is something that, quite frankly, I hadn't articulated as clearly as you have just now, which is that, in a way, there's a tension between, you know, and I talk about the miracle on ice in the 80s with the Olympics, you know, us Americans beating the Russians on ice, and that being understood as not just merely a victory on hockey, but, you know, proof that capitalism and democracy were better than socialism, you know? And and it's like, why? Why would a victory on ice in hockey demonstrate that? But that's how it was understood by everybody, and that's how the players understood it, that's how the coaches understood it, that's how the politician, and that's how the American public understood it. And so there's this tension between the particularity of something and the grand generalizations that we arrive at from that particular thing. Absolutely right. On the other hand, I also want to emphasize that it's very seldom that any particular event will decisively I mean, sometimes it's the case, but often it's not the case that it will decisively settle us and make us feel like we're done. You know, I guess if you win the Nobel Prize, you say, all right, you know, I don't have much else to prove. But the reality is that, you know, and the Michael Jordan example shows it, you know, it's part of our mentality is you never give up. You never stop running. I remember looking at these motivational posters at the gym, you know, and these guys, you know, there's one of them, a guy in the desert of Arizona, and he's just running into the sunset, and he says, the poster says, doesn't matter where you're going as long as you keep going, or something like that. I'm like, well, why? But aren't you going somewhere for a purpose? And then when you get there, you got to take stock of that, and you got to understand that, and then think about, you know, maybe you want to go somewhere else, maybe not. I mean, why are you running? And a part of our mentality is, no, we are going to keep on running. That's the important thing. And it just puzzles me. It's a contradiction. If you look at it, it's a contradiction because, you know, running has to have a purpose other than running itself. I mean, it's a motion. You're going from A to B. You're going from A to somewhere else. There has to be a reason for doing it, and it can't just be just in order to run. I mean, unless running is the final destination, I suppose. But I don't think that anybody would say that. So, you know, if you dig deeper, it's scary what you find in a way. You know.
Yeah. Well, the example of Michael Jordan is so interesting to me, you know, as a sports fan. He won so many championships and he still wanted to try and play baseball.
Yes.
And that didn't really work out. So, you know, I guess that basketball at that moment wasn't enough of a challenge. He had to try and prove himself in another sport. And then even after all his time with the Bulls, then he goes to play for the Washington Wizards, and he's no longer able to dominate the league the way that he used to. And it's almost, you know, quit while you're ahead kind of thing. You know,
right.
You'll end up looking more like a winner if you leave while you're on top. But, I mean, Brett Favre right now is another example.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Going from to the Jets and to the Minnesota Vikings, and now, you know, his great streak ended. And, I mean, to me, it's just kind of sad because it's like, you know, these guys, they don't know when to quit.
Right. And there are examples of people who gracefully, you know, bow out of from the stage. But on the whole, yes. And I heard a piece of when Michael Jordan was inducted into the Hall of Fame, I guess, not so long ago. It was a very long speech that he gave. And he said something along the lines of, you know, even though he's 45 now, I think, he said, "I may not be done. I may come back again. Don't underestimate me," you know? and you wonder, you know, again, what is he really after? What's he really after? What's really moving him? And equally importantly, has he stopped to think about it? And I think the answer is no. And the reason is that if you stop to think about it, there is a void that comes. There's a fear that comes from suddenly stopping and not running. And I think people are terrified by that thought. And I think it's easier to keep on running. It's much easier to just be on automatic than to stop. And there's all sorts of ways you can test that. You know, general social survey in the United States, large-scale surveys of values, comparative values with other countries. And you can test that proposition, you know, in terms of questions like, are you ever satisfied? How content are you with what you have? You know, all these things. And you see that Americans are very restless, very restless. There's a lot of anxiety in a certain way. You know, of course, it has an upside. It has definitely an upside, or certain upsides. But it also deserves investigation.
Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things you do is look at, you know, the language of competition and how this may be either a driving or a sustaining force in this whole confused dynamic. I thought it was really interesting. And again, one of these kind of obvious things that I hadn't really thought about, the way that we so often use these really generic, imprecise terms like leadership and organizational vision and transfer those from one area to another. So if someone has leadership qualities in business, then they ought to have leadership qualities in politics. And, you know, we're not actually talking about what they do specifically in those contexts that makes them good at what they do. And so we kind of overestimate how these skills translate from one context to another.
Yeah, absolutely. That happens a lot, and that's the Michael Jordan effect with baseball, right? Or, you know, there's plenty of examples of politicians who were former businessmen who thought, you know, I was very good at making tons of money, therefore I'm good at running the state of, you know, whatever, Minnesota or the state of, you know, New York, because I was good at that, I must be good at that. But it's an assumption that we also share, and, you know, as the public. I mean, we kind of assume that, and that's why, incidentally, that explains a great deal of the Tiger Woods story, is that our disappointment was not at all with golf. It's not as if he stopped playing golf very well. I mean, he kept playing golf very well. I mean,
right.
People were disappointed because they thought somebody who plays golf like that well and, you know, in that with that style, you know, and that obviously had spilled over to his other parts of life, or so we thought. And then we discovered that, in fact, his lifestyle doesn't match with his, you know, his lifestyle is vulgar, his golf is sublime, and that creates some sort of dissonance in our head, and our heads, and say, well, how can that be? But why should it not be? I mean, to be provocative, why not? If somebody is very good at golf, maybe he's a complete moral disaster in other respects. Why assume that if he's good at hitting golf balls, he ought to be a great father? There is no reason to assume that.
Yeah.
And of course, you want that, but why, you know, and then, you know, Spitzer, Governor Spitzer in New York State, same exact thing. It's a little more complicated there, but, you know, all these things we're surprised by, because we assume that, hey, if he's got to be good, if he's good at that, he's good at all the other things, and, you know, well, maybe not. Maybe why transfer that? But of course, because we think that, that's why we go after things, because if we succeed at X, then everybody would say he's a winner in general, yep, because he's so good at one thing. Or a loser.
Right. You know? Similarly, you point out, the Pete Rose with the, mm-hmm, gambling scandal and that just stripping his legacy of everything he had accomplished. And, I mentioned a little bit in email being a Philadelphia Eagles fan and all of the excitement around Michael Vick right now. You know, he's playing so well that when you hear the commentators talk about him, they can't seem to talk about his performance on the field without going to these kind of deeper qualities about him that must be changed. Yeah. And some of it makes perfect sense, because when they talk about how he's actually become a better pocket passer and the coaches have been able to work with him and he's listening to them, he's teachable, he's humble. But it seems like if I hadn't read your book and been thinking about this a little more critically, I probably would have bought into it a little more wholesale.
Right.
I mean, it's safe to assume that he is open to being coached on the football field more so than he was in the past, because we can see objectively his style of play has changed.
Yes.
But as much as I want to, as an Eagles fan and as, someone who likes to see that comeback story, I want to buy into, he's a changed man. He's a different person. What's most interesting to me is that we don't seem to be able to celebrate him as a football player without also kind of redeeming him as a person.
Exactly. No, exactly. It's a perfect example. We cannot fail to extrapolate.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, use the word underdog. That's another thing that that also is worth mentioning, and that is that the underdog is yet another element of our collective mindset. And it's a very dear strand of the winning/losing mentality in our culture. We love the underdog for a number of reasons. And it appears in a lot of our collective, stories. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was an underdog. And then he manages to get Ashley to be the lead, reindeer in a sleigh. And there are all sorts of things. I mean, the Odyssey with Ulysses gone, and then he's gone. There are lots of suitors after Penelope, and then he comes back from far away, and incidentally, who does he have to fight with? But his those who are potentially closest to him in terms of worth, i.e., the suitors. And it's Adam and Eve, Christianity. Really, it's Christianity. It's Jesus promising to the underdogs that you'll go to heaven. Don't worry about it. You're the underdog today, but you'll be rewarded later. There are all sorts of places where we find it, and it's one strand. And as I say in the book, there are several strands, contradictory strands, as to what makes a winner.
Well, it's interesting that you just now mentioned some of the more general Western traditions, because it seems like an important part of your experience that went into writing this book was the time that you spent in Denmark and noticing just how different things were there. Now, was the difference between America and Denmark something that you learned about as you talked to your colleagues there? Or was it really striking, the way that you describe those experiences that you've had here, individual events, kind of you just get hit with the essence of the culture?
If you went there for 3 days, you may not notice it. But if you stay there longer than 3 days, you notice it. And I've been going back and forth since 2004, but if you go into the main square of Copenhagen and you look up and Carlsberg beer, it's one of their most distinctive export products. Mm-hmm. They don't have a whole lot of distinctive brands, because there are a lot of Danish companies of mid to small size. So it's not like Finnish companies or Norwegian Nokia or Swedish, Volvo, Saab, IKEA. They don't have that. But Carlsberg is one of the flagship products. And guess what he says in the middle of the square in Copenhagen? He says, Carlsberg, probably the best beer in town. Probably. I mean, it's, whereas, and then think Budweiser, the king of beers.
Yeah.
And you see it, if you pay attention, it's really obvious in lots and lots of ways, the way people dress or the way their homes are set up. Even how I was giving a talk about this stuff precisely, I think it was in February in Denmark. No, in April. At the Copenhagen Business School, and I was giving a presentation on this very topic. And just to give you a sense, it was a room, very long U-shaped set of tables, if you will. And there were maybe 20 people, and most of them were PhD students. And in an American classroom, the kids would have been pretty much evenly distributed, you know, or at least not very close to each other. And in this classroom, they were all, if you imagine a U, they were all squeezed together on one of these three lines of the U. I don't remember which one. I think it was the not even the middle one. It was one of the sides. They were all together, very, very close to each other. And I told them, just the way you are, this is a sign of collectivity. This is a sign of not wanting to stick out. This is a sign of group mentality, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, there's so many ways in which it shows up. They're very modest. And so, no, it hits you. Then, of course, I had my kid in Danish kindergarten. And so he, you know, quickly learned how they teach things, what they teach and how they teach kids. They always teach kids to come second is just as well. There's nothing wrong with coming in second. Yeah. Second is just second, you know, it's not last, it's fantastic. And even if you come last, it's perfectly fine, because what matters is to participate. And winners are taught not to boast, not to be boastful. And, you know, just this past April, I was talking to them about this. And one Danish guy says, yeah, because, you know, what we think is that it's only okay to win if your victory helps the last guy move up. And that's like, all right, that's it. You know, that's like, what could be clearer, yeah. Right? You know, you can only win if you have everybody else lift up. But if you're winning means that somebody else gets left behind or gets even worse off, then we don't accept that. And that translates into, you know, one of the, you know, the highest tax rate in the world, a huge welfare system, you know, very little inequality and so on and so forth. So the moment you start looking around, you realize.
Yeah. Also, you know, that kind of attitude in an American business school would seem, it almost seemed like someone was being sarcastic.
Yeah, right.
Go on, seriously, you know.
Hey, but you know, David, the interesting thing is that you can say, you know, when I talk about this Denmark, you know, I've been given a lot of talks since the book was out because it has attracted interest, you know. And the reason it has attracted interest is because people are insecure, really, and otherwise they wouldn't be interested in it. So, you know, you can tell that they come. I gave a talk to a public library just the other day. It was full of parents with their kids, you know, and they're like, they're coming to hear me relieve them from the duty of having to win, really. I can see that. They're like, please tell us we don't have to push our kids so hard, you know? And I can tell that from their eyes. They're just sort of, please, please, you know, relieve us from this duty. So, yeah, I mean, you see it in all sorts of interesting ways. But I was going to say that the Danes, in the scale of having, you know, people get sort of, wow, well, I mean, Denmark sounds like a boring place. Yes, it is all these things, but they're also the happiest people on earth. They're some of the most content by any measure. And it's been so for 10 years or 15 years now. So are the Swedes and the Finnish. In the United States, does not come even in the top 10 in terms of happiness and life satisfaction. So they're doing something right.
Yeah,
you know, it's not just a sort of crazy socialist, semi-socialist place where everybody's depressed and drinking vodka. You know, not at all.
Well, I think what you mentioned about that, you know, it's important to kind of go a step further, which you do in the book. You're not advocating that we should try and model ourselves after any other country, but the message that I got is that they are clear about their values. So while we may not be able to just import values from Denmark, we kind of need to get our own values clear. Whether or not we can transfer those values is less important than whether we can figure out what it is that we want as individuals. And I think that's what's interesting about how you wrap the book up, is you're not trying to say America needs to spread this message across the nation that we are all equal and we need to stop competing so much. You know, the approach you take, which seems appropriate to the United States being as individualistic as we are, is to kind of urge us as individuals to think how we're confused, how the language that each one of us is using isn't that precise, and how we can kind of do better.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right. And I say it from the very first pages, I don't think we shouldn't become like Denmark, nor could we become like Denmark. So it's out of the question, and there's nothing that I'm advocating in that direction. But yeah, clarity of mind would do us a lot of good and would eliminate some of the anxieties, and then once you are clear about what you're really after, then you know, that's fine. If you're really after money, call it that. If you're after fame, we can discuss it if you want. But at least you're getting closer. You are after your parents' love. You want to be loved. You know, whatever it is that you want to feel like you're beautiful. Whatever it is that you're after, much better than to say that we're winning. Look, there, and then the way in which the confusion can be really a problem You know, I give examples. One is the war in Iraq when, you know, after, you know, beating the Iraqi military, we said, now that we've won the war, we must win the peace. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a perfect example of why do you have to call it winning the peace? What does it mean to put it in that way? Why isn't it securing the peace? Why isn't it establishing trust? Why isn't it? It's a void term, but also because, you know, something we didn't touch upon is that winning and losing aren't just confusing concepts if used improperly. They also are particular concepts that set up particular dynamics. Among the many is that they're antagonistic terms. And also they allow for the possibility, a particular kind of possibility, the possibility of being a loser, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't succeed. So if you fail to win the peace, have you lost the peace? You know, did you ever have the peace in the first place? And who are you fighting against to win the peace? Who are you taking it from, you know? Yeah. And there's another example is when I was writing this book, I was browsing some other books in the library, and virtually if you go to Amazon or another site and you look, put winning, 99, all books but mine, talk about how to go about winning, you know? And one book that I was looking at says win by losing, and I thought, what is this about, you know? So I was thinking, oh wow, this is interesting. And of course it wasn't, because it was the title was it was about, you know, win by losing weight. So yeah. Be a winner, you're fat, win become a winner by losing weight. And if you put it that way, it becomes confusing, but it generates dynamics. So who are you fighting against, you know, win by losing? So who are you fighting against? The fat cells? Are they going to beat you if you can't get rid of them, right?
Yeah.
So you, and also, by the way, they happen to be your fat cells. So if you are against your own fat and then your fat beats you, then is it you who beats yourself? And so why not simply say, you know, feel better, get rid of your weight, whatever it is, and leave aside all these other confusing things that are just, you know, just why? Why talk about it that way, you see? There's another thing I remember, to answer your first question, that another instigator for writing the book was I was sitting around at a diner in my own hometown here in Maine, and I read this local paper, and he said, and we are in a very competitive sort of school district, he said, John blah blah blah, the new head coach for softball, says you know, just hired from some other town, says he wants to win real bad. It was the headline, new coach softball wants to win real bad. And it was all about how great he is because he just wants to win.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what does he care? Well, why would he want to win and beat the town over? Besides, it doesn't even come from this town. It comes from, just like.
Right. The performance of these high school girls is going to define him.
Yes. Yeah. And also, you know, as I discussed, attacks on umpires and referees in the United States for, you know, non-professional games, high school games, junior high school games, even kids games are going up by a lot. Parents are furious, you know, as you know, the National Association of Referees, I don't remember the exact, sports officials, NASO, you know, now offers insurance to their referees for even, you know, middle school games because they get attacked, physically attacked. There are all sorts of, and the number of accidents is going up every year. And so it is important, you know, it's crazy that if you go to a, you know, suburban typical thing, these parents are out of control, half of them. And what does it do to the kids, you see? On the other hand, the kids, there's an increasing number of kids who prefer if their parents didn't watch them play. And that's an interesting statistic. So why don't they want to be watched, you know? And what a tragedy it is that they don't want to be watched. And people ask me, you know, what do you tell your kids? You know, my kid is 6 years old now, the older one, you know, and he's just started playing soccer. And so when he comes home or after the game is over, I don't ask him, did you win? I don't ask him, did you play well? I ask him, did you get out of it what you wanted to get out of it? And, you know, he looks at me puzzled, but that is the right question to ask.
You had mentioned the messages that your kid was getting in kindergarten in Denmark, and it's like those are familiar. I tutored in an elementary school in Boston when I was in college, and, you know, we said those kind of things, and I heard other teachers say them, but there was always this feeling like we were trying to tell them something that we knew was going to get kind of bowled over in just a couple years as they really became inundated with the culture, you know? I'm going to say this, but I'm not sure if I really believe it, you know?
Right. That's great. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, at 5 and 6, they're still, you know, non-competitive games and they rotate and everybody gets to do a home run at softball, you know, even though it's not really a home run. And But you're right. It's almost like a protection or almost a lie because, you know, it's years from now that all things are going to just fall apart.
I just remembered it was a pre-K class, 3 and 4 year olds, and they were writing in their sloppy little kid handwriting what they wanted to be. And this one kid, Jaden, scribbled some letters. And when the teacher asked him what he wrote, what he wanted to be, he said, "Trash man." And, you know, what he wanted to be at that point was a garbage man. He looked at the guy collecting the trash on the street, and they're riding on the back of the truck, and he must have thought, hey, that looks like fun, you know? Then it's when you kind of extend this idea of winning to what we choose to do for a profession or what we want to do in life, it's like, well, that's cute that he wants to be a garbage man, you know, but why is that somehow a less legitimate desire than something which we associate more with achieving?
Right.
Where something like business or something where we see the ability for someone to rise and make progress, so to speak. I guess it's discouraging while there's this potential, as you point out in the end of the book, for us to clean up our own language and our own thoughts about this. How do you actually change the ideas on a wider cultural level? I mean, I don't know.
Yes, I don't know either. And I don't see anywhere, you know, being changed. What's interesting, though, is that I do believe that the public in general is feeling less, and maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, if 10 years ago, I think the American public was pretty sure that everything in the United States was right. The United States was, we just won the Cold War, you know, maybe 15 years ago, you know, so mid-90s. We won the Cold War. Our system was, you know, we're the richest country in the world. Now with China coming up with our own problems at home and everything is looking a lot more problematic. And I sense, at least, maybe it's my perspective, there is a lot more questioning, self-questioning than there was even 5, 8 years ago, you know, because of the war in Afghanistan that's not going so well and the Iraq War. And, you know, there's less hubris. You know, we're going to invade countries and, you know, make them into democracies. You know, there's less of that. You know, we wouldn't do that again, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting as well, because if you listen to the Tea Party people, what they're, you know, Sarah Palin is, you know, a lot of her talks and speeches are about, be proud to be American. Isn't this a great day to be an American? She often opens like that, you know, which tells me that a lot of people are actually not feeling that way. Otherwise, she wouldn't have to say it, you know? So there's maybe there is a moment of introspection, but I don't, you know, I think it's a very ingrained thing. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. As you know, cultures don't change quickly. So we have to see. But on the other hand, you know, I talk to a lot of people about this stuff, and inevitably there is somebody who, first of all, a lot of people get what I'm saying, like yourself. I mean, you obviously clearly understood the book and made observations that I hadn't even thought about. So that's great. And I also meet lots of people, you know, that out of maybe 20, there's always a couple who say, well, I don't identify myself with this book. That's not talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just not like that. And I had a student in my class, and I thought this book the first time off a draft of it. She said, "You know, I'm just not like this." And I thought, well, that's good in a way. You know? on the other hand, you don't want to promote aimlessness, or you know, sort of saying, "Well, it's okay. You don't have to do anything." You know, I mean, I don't want to run that risk either.
Yeah.
I just want clarity. You know, clarity so that
sure.
So that, I mean, look, here's another example. You know, my kid, I always go back to my kids because I'm living it through them as well. And the older one is in first grade. And in second grade already, they'll talk about gifted versus non-gifted kids in math. And they're going to split them up. And, all right, so is your kid gifted? Yes, no. You know, like, okay, so your kid is 7 years old and he's not in the gifted group. Or he's in the gifted. What does it mean to say that to the kids?
Yeah.
Either way,
yeah.
Whether the kid is gifted or not, what does it mean to say that? I think it's terrible. I really think it's terrible.
Yeah.
I think we shouldn't have that. I mean, I think it could be disguised or rather crafted in a different manner. You know, I mean, if I think back to my own evolution, I think I'm fairly intelligent. You know, I'm not stupid. I'm not a genius. I'm, you know, fairly okay, you know. But when I look at my own evolution, you know, I succeeded at some things at some point in time and not others. I was preoccupied with some things at some time and not others, and then neglected something. Was I gifted, not gifted? What does it mean, you know? I was preoccupied with some things at one point and not others, you know? So that's it. Am I smarter, stupider because I thought about one thing more than somebody else who thought about something else? I mean, does it make me less gifted, more gifted? I mean, you know, I also think that intelligence manifests itself in many different ways. And just we have one particular way, math and writing early on and science. But that's just one way, and a particular way of doing math and a particular way of doing science. And, there, you know, the mind works in so many ways that just to say, well, you're good at that particular way, therefore you're universally gifted. And the other kid is not. It's just an insult to both, effectively.
Well, that does it for another exciting episode of the Office Hours podcast. We would like to thank our special guest contributor, David Philippi, for doing this interview, and we hope that he'll do some more. Again, as we said in the beginning of the show, if you're interested in being a guest contributor, let us know.
To subscribe to this podcast or to learn more about the research discussed today, check out our website at thesocietypages.org/officehours. As always, thanks to my Office Hours co-hosts, the entire TSP team at Minnesota, and the U of M's College of Liberal Arts for working overtime this past week to make sure that the massive amounts of snow atop our data center doesn't collapse the roof and postpone this podcast. See you soon.
Hey, didn't you say that last week?